It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, find out how the concept of trauma-informed care is changing Wisconsin schools, healthcare, and law enforcement. We'll preview a new documentary from Wisconsin Public Television. First, be honest now. If you have an office job and things are a little slow, do you ever sneak in a round of computer solitaire? It's quiet. You look like you're actually doing work if people can't see your screen. Just ask Pam and Jim on The Office. The iconic game from Microsoft is one of the newest inductees to the World Video Game Hall of Fame. The other three this time around are Colossal Cave Adventure, Mortal Kombat, and Super Mario Kart. The Hall of Fame is part of the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. John Paul Dyson is the director of the museum's International Center for the History of Electronic Games. John Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm really glad to be here.
Well, it's a terrible question to ask you here, John Paul, but I'm going to ask it right off the start. Do you have a favorite from the four new inductees?
You know, I have a personal favorite, which is Colossal Cave Adventure, which is probably the one that people have heard of the least. And that's because I played it back in 1982 when my parents got an Osborne personal computer, which is a portable computer the size of a suitcase. And my brother and I spent the summer playing it and eventually beating it.
Now, Colossal Cave Adventure, I don't think I ever played that version, but I think I played a different one just called Adventure. This is the one where, you know, on the screen it'll say you are at the mouth of a cave and you say walk east, right? And you just, it's all text.
Right, exactly. It's the same game. It was called Adventure, and later on they sort of started calling it Colossal Cave Adventure when it became more of a commercial game. And there were no graphics. It was all your imagination and the words you could enter. And it felt really magical at the time. It was not quite as pervasive as Windows Solitaire.
And why does a game, these four or the past inductees, what makes a game significant enough to make it into the Hall of Fame?
Well, there are hundreds of thousands, probably at this point, millions of games out there. And we really identify four criteria. The first is icon status. Is it iconic? The second is geographical reach. Is it played across national boundaries? Third is longevity. Did it last? And the fourth is probably the most important, which is influence. And that's a game like Colossal Cave Adventure was tremendously influential on other games, especially.
Well, let's look at the influence then that Colossal Cave Adventure had. Now, I know I was of the right age that I played that. It was just everywhere. And then there was a line of games, Zork and other text adventures, that followed on it with similar formats but kind of fancier stories. This kind of it kind of made it clear that you could make games on a computer in some ways.
Right. It's really the first computer game that opens up these imaginative possibilities, these pretend worlds that people think, wow, you can do something here other than maybe just a simulation, which might have been there before, or a simple game like a Pong-style game. And so it really opened these immersive worlds and set the course not only for games like Zork, which is a text-based adventure, but all the role-playing games, the fantasy games like World of Warcraft, or EverQuest, games like that, that have really come to dominate so much of the imagination, especially in multiplayer games.
Now, staying in the realm of not super fancy graphics, we get a little graphics here. Solitaire, Microsoft Solitaire, I think it just came with the computer for many people. That's been around in computers for a long time. Take us back to when Microsoft Solitaire first showed up on our computers.
So Microsoft Solitaire is one of those games that turned almost everyone into a gamer who had a computer. You know, he may not have played a game like Colossal Cave Adventure, but you knew Solitaire. And so when you got this new computer with Windows 3.0, all of a sudden there was this game package on there, Solitaire, which you probably knew how to play from regular cards. And so you started clicking and dragging. And through clicking and dragging, you also then learned to use this new device that came with your computer, which was a mouse. And that was sort of the quiet, stealth reason that Microsoft put it in there, in part, was to help people understand how do you use this new thing that you need to move the cursor around with on the computer.
We are talking about the history of video games and the new inductees into the Video Game Hall of Fame. John Paul Dyson is with us from the International Center for the History of Electronic Games. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite all-time video game or computer game, however you want to slice and dice those phrases, what would you want to see in the Hall of Fame? Or do you have a question about whether a favorite game of yours has made it in yet? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John Paul, before we get to the other new inductees, I'm guessing a lot of times you get questions from people about why their favorite game isn't in the Hall of Fame or not yet. I know one of my all-time greatest time sucks, Civilization, and its sequels, isn't in there. It was one of the nominees this year, though.
Right. Sid Meier's Civilization was nominated this year. It has not yet made it over the top, and it's a pretty high hurdle. It's only 24 games right now into the World Video Game Hall of Fame. I was looking at a list earlier, I think, I guess that game's not in yet, there yet. So people can nominate their favorite game, and we take those very seriously.
All right, let's get back to this year's inductees. This is one, I'm guessing a lot of people would be behind this one, Super Mario Kart. It's the characters from Super Mario Brothers, a series that's gone on forever, racing each other on go-karts. What made that one special?
Well, interesting, it's our first racing game that gets in, and it's also the game that really launched, I think, the Mario extended franchise, you might say. The Mario was already there as a game, but this is one that really brought anyone into the action. So you don't need to be a good gamer, a good person at racing games to feel like you actually have a chance in this one. I'm terrible at racing games, and I actually get in there and feel like, oh, maybe I'll win this time. Usually I still lose anyway, but it's a wonderful social game, and that's one of the things that, you know, some games like Solitaire is, as the name says, is a solitary activity, but video games are often actually tremendously social, and so Super Mario Kart is a good example of how it brought people together to play in one space and really have a lot of fun together.
And have we seen that inspire a lot of other games where you sit down in person and I guess now sit down online to play together?
Right. The whole growth of online gaming has been huge. And it really is all over the board between games like Super Mario Kart, where you're all in the same room, you're talking to each other, to games where maybe you're wearing a headset and you're talking with people, games like Fortnite or Call of Duty, where there's online communication going on as you're playing. They're different types of social involvement with each other, but they're both highly social in nature.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Holly is with us in Wausau. Holly, hello.
Hi.
What games did you want to bring up, Holly?
I used to play Elder Scrolls, Morrowind, Oblivion, Skyrim. I've been playing World of Warcraft since the end of the Burning Crusade, and I've been playing on and off ever since.
Holly, thank you so much for sharing those. So those are two big Elder Scrolls. Now, I've never played this one, but John Paul, this has had, as she was saying, like a zillion different incarnations and versions and sequels over the years.
Right, and that's very common with video games. You get something that works and becomes a franchise, and whether it's different individual games that are all sort of linked together or expansion packs. World of Warcraft, for instance, which she mentioned as well, which is in the World Video Game Hall of Fame, is one of those where they're constantly adding new content that keeps the game fresh for the millions of players who play it.
And World of Warcraft, I'm not surprised that's in the Hall of Fame. Again, I haven't played the massive multiplayer version, but that really put that whole idea of having lots and lots of players interacting in the same game world on the map, right? That was the first big hit that did that, if I remember right.
Yeah, there were games like EverQuest and Ultima Online before then, but it was really the one that, in the public imagination, sort of, I think, cemented what it meant to join together and to be a part of a guild where everyone would, you know, rush home on Friday night because their guildmates were relying on them to go on a raid or something like that. And so it really was the game that popularized, I think, for the public imagination, that idea of what you call an MMO, a massively multiplayer online game.
We're talking about this year's inductees to the World Video Game Hall of Fame. They include Microsoft Solitaire, Colossal Cave Adventure, Super Mario Kart, and Mortal Kombat. The hall is part of the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. John Paul Dyson is with us, director of the museum's International Center for the History of Electronic Games. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have fond memories of playing any of those games? Which games do you think belong in the Video Game Hall of Fame? What's the first game you remember getting hooked on, if you've ever gotten hooked on a video game? What do you see your kids playing? What do you play today? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Fans of Super Mario Kart will recognize that music. We're talking about the World Video Game Hall of Fame's 2019 class. It includes Mario Kart, along with Colossal Cave Adventure, Microsoft Solitaire, and Mortal Kombat. The Video Game Hall of Fame is part of the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. John Paul Dyson is with us, director of the museum's International Center for the History of Electronic Games. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Is there a game that shaped your childhood, your adulthood? If you played any of these Hall of Famers, do you have a favorite video or electronic game to play at the arcade, the home computer, the handheld, the console? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John Paul, before we go back to our callers, let's talk about the fourth inductee we haven't talked about, one that people may have played first at the arcade, Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, Mortal Kombat was this game that came out in 1992 and really raised this tremendous ruckus about violence in video games, especially. It was a game that was really released to combat another game that's in the World Video Game Hall of Fame, Street Fighter II. But it was a huge hit in the arcades. But then when it was ported to the homes, all of a sudden people saw all this violence being brought into the homes. Now, we look back at it now, and it seems sort of cartoonish and over the top, you know, so almost more like a cartoon we would have watched on Saturday morning than something to really take seriously. But at the time, people got quite exercised about it. And you may remember that Joe Lieberman, vice presidential candidate, went on stand and led this effort in the Senate to have video games regulated. And the result was that the video game industry, as industries often do, it's a similar pattern, for instance, with comic books or with movies, they try to forestall Congress. And so they instituted their own ratings code, which is known as the ESRB. So when you go and buy a video game today at the store, it has a rating on there. And so it might be, for instance, might say mature for mature content. And one of the, unintended effects of this was actually by introducing ratings for older gamers, for adults who had grown up gaming or now wanted to keep playing, it actually introduced much more mature content into video games, which is something that players wanted, but may not have happened as quickly without all the controversy over Mortal Kombat.
Let's go back to our callers now. We have John on the line in Fitchburg. John, hello.
Hey, Rob. I just wonder what your guest thinks about good old Pac-Man.
Was that a favorite of yours, John, back in the day or maybe today?
Was my daughter, and I followed when she was a child, and she still loves it in her late 40s.
All right. Thanks a lot. So Pac-Man, John Paul.
Yeah, Pac-Man was obviously an extremely successful game, and it is in the Hall of Fame. And it's one of those games that really brought video games to wide attention. I mean, you had Pong before in Space Invaders, but there was Pac-Man fever. I mean, there were songs being written about
right.
Pac-Man, birthday parties. We have these truly atrocious Pac-Man costumes that you could have worn for Halloween back in 1980. And it was one of the most successful games of all time. And actually, it inspired a sequel, which is not by the same company. It was sort of a hack called Ms. Pac-Man, which is actually a better game. And I'm sort of waiting for Ms. Pac-Man to get into the Hall of Fame. Somehow, it hasn't been have made it yet, but I think it will eventually.
Now, what I think back about Pac-Man is that, okay, before that, you mentioned Pong. You had games that were like kind of like, you know, table tennis or something like that. Space Invaders, where you're shooting at stuff. Pac-Man, where did that come from? It demonstrated you could have weird ideas and make games out of them.
Right, exactly. The Japanese designer, I heard him say at a session one time, and who knows if this is the truth. He tried to think of a game that would attract girls, and he said, "Well, what do girls like to do?" So they have to eat. Now it seems pretty universal to me. So he said, "But he said that's what inspired him." Exactly, and supposedly the sort of pizza shape as well. So it does show that a video game can have almost any theme you want. I mean, you're talking later about the Oregon Trail, which is also in the World Video Game Hall of Fame, and there's almost no limit to what the themes are that a video game can pursue. And so we often think of video games as being linked with shooting or with battling. But really, you know, a game like The Sims, for instance, which is essentially like a digital dollhouse, is in the World Video Game Hall of Fame. And so there's endless possibilities. Pretty much any form of play that happens in the real world can be transformed and experienced in new ways in the digital world.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to AC in Madison now. AC, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you got for us?
Hey, I actually have two crazy games. Obviously, the one most popular would probably be like Pokemon Go. Mm-hmm. Everybody like is all over Pokemon Go. I mean, it breeds a great like sense of community for people to come together and play this game, because like a lot of the objectives, like raids and things, you can't really do on your own. So I think that one should definitely be a shoo-in. And then the one following is kind of a cult classic-y game that never actually got released, called Thrill Kill. We talked about Mortal Kombat and how grotesque it was, but Thrill Kill for its time is one of these games where like it got completely shelved and no one even wanted to pick it up because it was so grotesque.
Thanks for the call, AC. Well, pretty much opposite ends of the spectrum there. Let's start with Pokemon Go, John Paul.
Yeah, Pokemon Go is definitely an interesting game. I mean, it was based in, there's an earlier game called Ingress, but they which used some of that same location-based sort of finding creatures. But Pokemon Go is a perfect marrying of that capability with the Pokemon franchise. And we have Pokemon Red and Green in the World Video Game Hall of Fame. So I wouldn't be surprised if Pokemon Go made it at some point. It's still a little young. I look back and the most recent game we have is actually World of Warcraft, which is in 2004. So there are probably some games after that, but maybe a few years before Pokemon Go comes in. And Thrill Kill, I can honestly say, I don't think it's ever been suggested at all before for the World Video Game Hall of Fame. So,
all right. Thank you so much for that call. We're talking about the World Video Game Hall of Fame with John Paul Dyson from the International Center for the History of Electronic Games at the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234 with your favorite video games. Alex is with us in Fenimore. Alex, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What do you got for us, Alex?
Well, you know, it's really hard to pick just one with the width and breadth of games being everything from text adventure to cinematic endeavors, but I have to admit that my personal favorite has to be Zelda: A Link to the Past from the SNES.
And have you played a lot of the Legend of Zelda series, Alex?
I've played quite a few of the earlier games, but a lot of the newer ones have been lost on me up until the Breath of the Wild came out on Switch, and that is probably one of the few games that harkens back to that original one where it's literally go anywhere, do anything, but there's a little bit more focus with, you know, what you have to do.
Alex, thanks for the call. And that's another long series, John Paul, The Legend of Zelda and the various permutations of that.
Yeah, if Las Vegas were setting odds on which franchise would get two games into the World Video Game Hall of Fame, I think Zelda would have a good chance, especially people often cite Ocarina of Time, which is one of the earlier games. But yeah, I agree with that Breath of the Wild that the caller mentioned, which is what's often called an open world game. I think Holly earlier mentioned Skyrim too, which is sort of similar to that, where you can go anywhere. And it really speaks to the way that video games can open up these imaginative possibilities.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard from some people on Facebook as well, John Paul. Brandy says she would nominate Super Mario World. Now you have Super Mario Kart. Are there no others from Donkey Kong on through the various Mario, Super Mario World games in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, so both Donkey Kong and Super Mario Brothers are both in the World Video Game Hall of Fame. Donkey Kong is where Super Mario originated. He was a plumber known as Jumpman, and he created by a guy named Shigeru Miyamoto, who's maybe the most prominent video game designer of all time. And his colors were perfectly designed to fit the limited graphical capabilities of an arcade machine, but they really stick. Back in the 90s, there was a survey done of kids, who was more recognizable, Mickey Mouse or Mario, and I believe Mario won quite handily. So.
And we heard from Matthew on Facebook, who casts a vote for Tecmo Super Bowl. It's a football video game from the early 1990s, and that started a lively argument between Matthew and their friend over who beat who back in the day. And that makes me think, John Paul, I know some people here at work, they hit Tecmo Super Bowl at just the right time. It was a little after my prime time for gaming. How important is the generational background for which games resonate with one of us?
Definitely, the game you grew up playing, especially probably about the age of 12, seems to be about the signal age when it's branded in your memory and you go back. We actually have at the museum, we have a couple of good examples of that. One is a giant Super Mario Brothers controller. And I joke, it's the only game that parents can beat their kids at because they sit down and that muscle memory is still there. But another example, again, is Oregon Trail. And people will come in and it'll be like being back at the math lab back in middle school. And all of a sudden you're gearing up for the adventure and going to head out and hoping you don't die of dysentery along the way.
Let's bring on another caller. Steven is with us in Madison. Steven, hi.
Hi. I was wanting to bring up including competitive esports into the Video Game Hall of Fame. My personal favorite is the Counter-Strike series.
Thanks for that call, Steven. So Counter-Strike series and those competitive esports, how are those changing the face of video games, John Paul?
It really is fascinating because for listeners who don't know, esports is where people are essentially watching other people play video games, which 30 years ago, people would have scoffed at that notion. And I remember being at one party in Buffalo recently where the Bills game wasn't on. They had an esports game on it. I thought, oh, okay, wow, times have changed here. So it's one of those things where it's really grown. It grew out of East Asia, especially. Korea was really the center of it. And that's one of the things you see about video games is one reason why we take geographical reach into account is that they're a worldwide phenomenon. And so trends go across the world. So, for instance, with mobile games, this idea of free-to-play, where you pay little bits to keep playing. A game like Candy Crush Saga, for instance, was a finalist this year. A lot of that started in places like China and Korea, where it was a way to have these microtransactions where you could make a little bit of money. So it's definitely a worldwide phenomenon, and esports is definitely part of that.
In our last minute or so, John Paul, what do you think the next generation of video games are going to look like?
You know, it's sort of this battle. On the one hand, we have games on our phone have become ubiquitous, and that's really turned so many of us into gamers. Even people who might not consider themselves a gamer, as we use that term, are likely playing some sort of game, whether it's Candy Crush or Words with Friends, something like that. On the other hand, you have this prospect of these virtual reality or augmented reality that came up earlier, and that's the sort of I have sort of a wait and see attitude about things like virtual reality, for instance, because it's definitely going to be somewhere in the future, but there's that sometimes isolating effect of that. So we'll see how quickly it takes off. I think you'll see that more in things like training simulations and educational stuff rather than lots of people running out to get VR headsets right away. It'll come eventually, I'm sure, but not maybe as fast as its boosters would like.
John Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Enjoyed it.
That's John Paul Dyson, director of the Strong Museum's International Center for the History of Electronic Games. We talked with him about this year's inductees into the World Video Game Hall of Fame. You can share your memories and your favorites at the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we'll talk about the Oregon Trail, a new twist from the perspective of Native Americans on the market now. Coming up, a look at a Wisconsin Public Television documentary on trauma-informed care. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new study shows that some hospitals may turn away ambulances in part because the patients are more likely to be low income. We'll talk about how common that is, possible reasons, and what it means for those who need emergency care. First, a new documentary is debuting on Wisconsin Public Television tonight at 8 o'clock. It's called Not Enough Apologies, Trauma Stories. It looks at the impact of childhood trauma and how the right kind of treatment and care can make a huge difference in the lives of survivors and their loved ones. Dane County Circuit Judge Everett Mitchell, himself a survivor of child abuse, summed up the concept this way.
I really have embraced the idea, like Frederick Douglass said, it is far easier to build strong children than to repair broken men.
Frederica Freiberg is the anchor of Here and Now, Wisconsin Public Television's live weekly program that covers news on state issues and politics around the state. She produced the new documentary, Not Enough Apologies. Fred, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Start us off with this concept. In some ways, it's all over the place, but it might still be new to people. Trauma-informed care.
Well, you know, we worked closely with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and their experts talked with us about their version of trauma-informed care, which I think is quite global and universal. They say, this is the Department of Health Services, that there are four elements to trauma-informed approaches: realizing the prevalence of trauma, recognizing how it affects people, responding by putting this knowledge kind of into practice, and then resisting re-traumatization. And these are all kinds of elements that we tried to look at through the course of this program, kind of this awareness of trauma, and then how trauma makes people behave, which might not be recognized right away as trauma, but just as, you know, kind of bad acting.
Right. And an amazing thing is these kind of traumas, adverse childhood experiences, they're often called, we'll get into what some of those are, they can actually affect brain development.
That's correct. We spoke with a physician from Children's Hospital of Wisconsin who showed us brain scans of a child, a three-year-old child who had experienced extreme neglect, which is clearly an adverse childhood experience. And neglect is probably one of the main reasons for children being removed from their homes. But on these brain scans, the brain literally was smaller in a child who had experienced extreme neglect.
And a story that seems to happen again and again is that that young person who's experienced neglect or abuse or a variety of other adverse experiences, they end up in a classroom or a foster setting or maybe even a criminal justice setting, and people see their behavior and it seems impulsive, irrational. They can't understand what's going on. That may be because of these brain changes from adverse experiences as a kid.
That's what experts told us, and they said that people should look at behavior as communication, and what these children may well be trying to communicate is their trauma.
Well, I want to get into, you share just really some powerful stories of people who have been through these and survived these adverse experiences. Let's start with Raina Saldana about how her trauma would come to the surface in her life.
Shut down was probably the biggest thing. I shut down, and a lot. And this wall that I built was an aggressive one. I would go into a room that was empty, and I'd probably just demolish things. I'd have people that would block the door, or they'd corner me, or they'd try and get me to not leave. And then I would have an outburst, and they'd be like, you're hurting people. You're destroying things.
So what did you take away from Raina's story?
I would say the first thing I took away from Raina's story is that she is an amazingly resilient young woman. She described the trauma that she had in her childhood and how it was not recognized, and that she felt that if people did recognize that trauma kind of informed children's behavior, she wouldn't have gone through as much as she did. She ended up in a series of institutions, really, where because of her violent outbursts, they would restrain her, and that was the definition for her kind of re-traumatization. And so it has taken her a long time to work through this, and she is successfully working through it to the extent that she speaks publicly on this issue.
There's a lot of bad stuff in the stories you tell. You also see signs of hope, people changing how they treat younger people going through these experiences, and people who you might fear it's too late for them.
That's really the sad truth, is that perhaps for some people, the kinds of trouble that they've gotten themselves into because of their behavior, it may well be very hard for them to come back from. But it seems that they're is always hope. Judge Everett Mitchell, who starts the documentary and ends the documentary, talks about there is hope. There is hope because he himself is a survivor of abuse, and he made his way, and he was able to build his own personal resilience through connections that he had and connections he had with his church and by becoming a preacher.
Talking to Frederica Freiberg about her new Wisconsin Public Television documentary, Not Enough Apologies, Trauma Stories, looking at the impact of childhood trauma on kids, on their adult lives, and new efforts to try to tackle some of these problems. I want to look at another part of the medical story here, the fight or flight response people might have heard about, how people react to traumatic situations. You also heard from some experts the idea of fight, flight, and freeze. I want to hear Alicia Fox talking about the freeze response when she was a child.
When I was 14, it was bad. I get flashbacks, nightmares. I would space out. I'd sit in class, and 4 hours later, I'd still be in the same seat. Like, oh, I was supposed to go to lunch. Like, I guess that didn't happen.
Tell us Alicia's story a little bit, Fred.
Alicia is another amazing young woman. She was sexually abused and assaulted by her father for 10 years, from the age of 4 to the age of 14, when she realized that this wasn't what was supposed to be happening to her as a child. She ended up being taken care of ultimately by her grandmother and her aunt, where she lives in a very loving, supportive home. She went through a lot of work, however, to get to the place where she is, mental health work, and lots of trauma-informed practices. She still suffers from many of the things that happened to her because of her trauma. But she's now in school full time and eventually wants to get a master's degree in psychology. So another kind of amazing story of trauma and resilience.
Now, in the documentary, you find a lot of people waking up to this problem. Judge Mitchell, you talked about, you have state lawmakers, the former First Lady of Wisconsin, a lot of local providers. I want to key in on two local efforts that you focus on, the first in Waupaca County.
Waupaca County says that they first learned about trauma-informed care from former First Lady Tonette Walker, whose platform was trauma-informed care, and she had a group called Fostering Futures. And the director of Health and Human Services in Waupaca County decided this was exactly what he needed to do. He wanted to their number one goal, they say, is to try to keep children in their homes. In other words, not removing children and placing them with strangers in foster care or in other kinds of settings. It's kind of an amazing story of a 180 that this Department of Human Services did, all the way from the way they engage with and treat their employees to how they work in terms of their child protective services staff.
And amazing stories. I mean, they're going into homes, working with parents in some cases, and you share one of those stories to try to help maybe that parent who is a victim of abuse themselves break the cycle for their own kids.
There's definitely a generational trauma that happens, and one of our experts in the film calls it ghosts in the nursery, because it's difficult for parents to know how to parent when they haven't been parented. So kind of learning how to model parenting behavior. And yes, Waupaca County and other counties are doing this, although it's a heavy lift. Mm-hmm. It's a heavy lift because there are a lot of families in this circumstance, and there are things right now that are making it increasingly difficult for counties to fund their child welfare services.
Another place that was tackling this and dealing with these generational issues was the Menominee Nation here in Wisconsin. Again, an amazing story. Can you tell us a little bit about what you saw there?
Yeah, this is an amazing story. What they like to do is they recognize, first of all, the deep generational and historical trauma within their population and the children in their schools. And so what they are doing is they try to greet every child with positive touches. In other words, saying good morning and welcoming them and being friendly before the kids ever even get into the classroom. And then they measure how their kids are feeling that day really intentionally. They either put a little stick in a bucket that says that they're feeling good or bad, or they do so on a computer. And so they're really monitoring and understanding where the kids are at when they're with them during the school day. And it seems to really be working for them. The superintendent there says that they went from a 60% graduation rate before they embarked on this very intentional work around trauma to a 90% graduation rate.
Amazing. We'll leave it there, but there are a lot more stories to share in the documentary itself. Fred, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Frederica Freiberg is the anchor of Here and Now, WPT's live weekly program that covers Wisconsin issues and politics. She produced the new documentary, Not Enough Apologies, Trauma Stories, which is premiering tonight on Wisconsin Public Television at 8 p.m. You can watch it online at wpt.org/trauma. Coming up, if you're in an ambulance, you probably assume you're being taken to the closest hospital with the best care and the one you want to go to. What if that hospital decides not to take more patients? A new study says it may be more common than people think. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you grew up with the computer game Oregon Trail, there's a new game with a twist, a journey from a Native American perspective. We'll meet the creator of When Rivers Were Trails. First, when the emergency room at a public hospital becomes overcrowded, the facility may close its doors so that additional patients don't have to wait a long time for care. A new study from California says when that happens at public hospitals, nearby private hospitals may close their doors too to avoid treating patients who are more likely to be poor. That can be a serious problem for anyone who happens to need emergency care during that time. It's an issue that hasn't been studied much, partly because data is hard to come by, but many health professionals say it's more common than people realize. John Diedrich is an investigative reporter and assistant editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. John, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, John, before we get into this California study, you've been following this issue of emergency room temporary closures to people in ambulances for a while. Can you tell us about the one tragic story that you started following?
Yeah, this was a case here in the Milwaukee area and about 4 years ago, a little bit more than 4 years ago. The case of Tiffany Tate, she worked at the Medical College of Wisconsin as a food service worker, and that is next door, basically on the same general proximity of Frederick Hospital. She began suffering what quickly became apparent was a stroke, and they called the paramedics, the Wauwatosa Fire Department. But when they got there, it would be a short ride next door to Frederick in its top level stroke center. But they could not go. They were turned away. The hospital, in fact, was turning away all patients at that time. And Tiffany Tate ultimately went to a hospital that didn't have as high a level of care and then was transferred again and died a time later. And this got me onto this story of, like, I had not heard this. And as I'm following this, many people did not know that hospitals can, if they deem it necessary, close their doors to all ambulances. It's a process or a practice known as ambulance diversion. It's gone on for a long time. People in hospitals certainly know about it, and paramedics do, but the general public does not.
So there's this thing, this diversion. Hospitals can say emergency rooms, we're too busy, we can't take more patients. So those ambulances, not the people who show up walking or driving, they have to be taken according to federal law. But ambulances can be diverted. And there's this question of, well, are they doing it because they're worried about people's ability to pay or how much they get paid? Now, let's bring this California study into it. It gets a little complicated, but sort it out for us, John.
Well, you point out a good point that this is only keeping away the ambulances themselves. So if you drive up, you have to be treated. What this researcher was interested to look at, because hospitals have said all along, this is a matter of volume. And, you know, we're only doing it for the safety and convenience of our patients. And it would be much better for you to go to a different hospital. What this researcher from Penn State and her colleagues found looking at data from California, the most complete data that was available was an interesting to see the reaction by private hospitals when a public hospital, that would be a government-owned hospital nearby them, went on diversion. They acted differently than they would if a fellow private hospital went on diversion. And they measured it by three different ways. They went on, those hospitals closed the doors quicker. They closed them with a lower census in their emergency room. And then they opened up faster when the first hospital that went on diversion was a public hospital. This idea that hospitals go on diversion when each other goes on diversion, that's not really new. It's sort of like a game of dominoes, and one goes down and then another one goes down and so forth. But what this study is significantly finding is that there's a potential financial implication or motivation here, because the patients who would be turned away from the public hospital that are more likely to be Medicaid or have no insurance at all, so lower paying government health insurance or not paying at all. And so what this research found, and they controlled for a number of other elements to make sure they weren't missing something here, but what they found is a possible and more research is needed, but a possible financial motivation for going on diversion.
It's a tricky issue to study, John, because I think no hospital is going to say, yeah, we're going to shut down on purpose when that public hospital is closed because we don't want low-paying or non-paying patients coming in the doors. It's hard to use data in a way to figure out if that's happening.
Well, it is, and certainly nobody's going to write that down or say that. What this rigorous study, it's peer reviewed, and they've been working on this data for a while. They found by a statistically significant difference the reaction that hospitals did. What they did is they matched up hospitals that were near enough to each other, that were peer hospitals. They were about the same size. They controlled for a bunch of different elements that, you know, confounding elements that could throw off the findings of this. And they found as they controlled for all these things that there was a significant difference when that first hospital that closed was a public hospital as opposed to a fellow private hospital.
Talking to John Diedrich from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the practice of emergency room diversion, saying, hey, our doors are closed, at least for now, to patients coming in via ambulance. John, in your longer-term reporting on this, you found that sometimes these diversions happen not because there's more people coming into the emergency room, but because of how the hospitals schedule their non-emergency procedures.
Yeah, that's the real interesting background of this, and I'm glad you raised that. So while the approximate sort of cause of this would be, oh, how many people are in the ED and how many people are coming into the emergency department or the emergency room, the actual cause of this is the flow through the rest of the hospital. So the inside term or the industry term is it's a throughput issue. So it's not what's coming in the front door. It's how quickly admissions are made, how surgeries are scheduled. You referred to that. Oftentimes, hospitals schedule surgeries on Mondays and Tuesdays, elective surgeries, which are very lucrative. And so hospitals don't want to move those around, and they also don't want to make surgeons who are doing those procedures unhappy. So that can create bumps in their process. And the reason we know this is because this has actually been – this issue has been addressed in a number of places, a growing number of places, most significantly Massachusetts, for the last 10 years. It hasn't allowed diversions at all. And they didn't do it by adding a bunch of beds or making doubling the size of the ED. They did it through a series of procedural changes in how the processes work throughout the hospital in terms of, you know, how schedules, surgeries are smoothed out and how quickly admissions can be made and discharges and things of that nature. So it's really what it is a it's a whole hospital issue that just sort of lands on the emergency department because they're at the front door.
And you write that Milwaukee County is one of those government entities that's trying to get this under control.
That's right. They are one of the largest area to most recently ended, and this was voluntarily here in Milwaukee County. And they were actually in the process of ending diversions when Tiffany Tate's case happened, her stroke case. But again, here in Milwaukee County, it was ended through not increasing bed sizes, bed capacity or that sort of thing, but changing the processes, talking to hospital executives in town. That's how they did it. And it's a playbook that's being followed in a number of places, though our research indicates that three quarters of the largest 25 cities in the country still allow it. And in some places, it continues to be quite an acute problem. And I should note, outside of Milwaukee, ambulance diversion is still allowed in the rest of the state of Wisconsin.
And in our last minute, John, what are you watching for next when it comes to hospitals diverting, sending away ambulances at certain times instead of accepting them in their emergency rooms?
Well, what's interesting, and you mentioned this with the data, there's a real lack of data out there, and we've noted that in our investigation, and this researcher did as well. What they've been able to do, though, is they've shown that that diversions delay care and in some cases have led to higher rates of death and complications in certain areas. So the researchers with the data that they have found a number of significant findings, and they say what they need is more data. And as an investigative reporter, I would definitely echo that.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's John Diedrich, investigative reporter and assistant editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to them about a new study showing that some private hospitals turn away ambulances, possibly for financial reasons, when patients are more likely to be poor. Health officials say that can cause potentially life-threatening delays for anyone in need of ambulance during that time of diversion. We also talked about his ongoing series looking at hospital diversions here in Wisconsin. You can find the stories he's written about that over the last year or so. It's all over at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel website. And if you work in an ER and have experienced this firsthand, I'd love to hear your story. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Good Lord, what is happening in there?
Aurora Borealis.
Aurora Borealis. At this time of year, at this time of day, in this part of the country, localized entirely within your kitchen.
Yes.
That probably wasn't the Northern Lights in Principal Skinner's kitchen on The Simpsons, but neither is the next thing we're talking about. It's not the Aurora Borealis, it's Steve. Judith Sears Poisson, you talked about Steve. I think I was off this
you
day.
You must have been off that day. It was last August, I believe.
Wow, it's been a while. So it's this thing that's like the Northern Lights, but not the Northern Lights. Tell us about it.
So, yeah, so they thought it was some form of the Aurora Borealis. They named it Steve after a kids' movie where some animals find a hedge that they don't know what it is and they're scared. So they name it Steve so it's not as scary. And so they took they made a backronym out of it. They took the name Steve and then they created the word Steve is strong thermal emission velocity enhancement. And it turns out that it's not quite an Aurora Borealis kind of thing.
So, but the new news is there's new research on what's causing it.
Right. So they found out that it's a burst of ions that are coming into the atmosphere, and it can actually create kind of a picket fence look, which I think would be really cool to see.
So I've never seen the Northern Lights.
Nor have I.
I've never seen Steve,
nor
to my knowledge. So another regret in my life. Judith, thanks for bringing us up to date on that.
Sure, on Steve.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.